This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices, united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
Welcome back to another edition of the Dustin McComas Show on theyak.com. I am, of course, Dustin McComas of orangebloods.com. And yes, we are going to talk some college football, damn it. Today, I'm happy to say I'm joined by Max Olson of The Athletic. Max just did a really great story, part of his State of the Program series, and this time he tackled the Texas Longhorns. So it felt like a good time to bring Max on the show. First off, Max, how are you doing? How's the family doing? You staying safe, staying busy, staying sane during all this coronavirus stuff?
Yeah, man. Appreciate you asking. We're doing okay over here. It's wild, man. It's crazy to think back on how, like, just like February seems like years ago at this point. You know, it's just crazy how this year has gone. But no, we're fortunate. Family's doing well. How about you?
Yeah. Trying to stay sane with a 3-month-old in the house, which has kind of felt like Groundhog Day sometimes. It's like the same thing. But it has been a bit of a blessing in that it went from literally, you mentioned February, it went from like the busiest part of my schedule to like everything stopping, which afforded me as much time as possible to spend with the little guy. But yeah, everything's good. We're kind of itching to try to get back to normal, you know, keeping our sanity intact as best we can.
At least we know how to work from home, right? I mean,
yeah,
we're used to that
that's
forever,
that's the blessing is, you know, it's something my wife is having to adjust to now. And I was like, now you understand that, like, during kind of slowish times for me when I'm not really at games or press events or on the road or whatever, like when you come home on Friday and I'm like itching to go out, like just to go or go eat somewhere, mm-hmm. just to get out of the house, and you're like, oh, I just want to stay at home. Now you understand, like this. Now you get this whole idea of when you have to stay at home all the time, how that affects you mentally, and that you just have to get out of the house because you go stir crazy.
Yeah, I think people are starting to understand something that you and I have known for a long time, which is like you have to eventually develop some discipline with this stuff. It looks like we've got it easy where we can just sit around in basketball shorts and type on our computers all day and like have the TV on and play video games and stuff. But like you have to figure out how to get work done, you know? So it's funny to see everybody. My wife's the same way. We had to set up a little office at home here, and she can see that, oh, it actually is hard to you know, get your work done and not be on the clock 24/7, you know?
Yeah, no, it's not an easy task. You've got to get yourself into the right mental space. And if you don't, you blink and it's like 4 PM and you've like, what have I done today?
For sure.
And I've got to work to 10 or 11 PM to get all that stuff done. So yeah, it's been an adjustment, and you know, hopefully things can slowly start to get back to normal. And kind of speaking of that, I don't think we can discuss college football without, when is college football going to happen? You know, last week the big news, broken by one of your colleagues at The Athletic, was about the Big Ten, and just kind of, I think it's fair to say, catching some, at least some people off guard the news about going to just a conference only schedule. So if there was ever a question about whether all of these conference leaders and decision makers were on the same page, I think the Big Ten answered it for us last week, in that they might talk and communicate a lot, but they're not all totally on the same page. So just first with that piece of news, what kind of ripple effect do you think that had on just the college football landscape, as we kind of saw the Pac-12 kind of aligned that way, but also the SEC and the Big 12 kind of stepping back and saying, hey, we're not quite ready to go that far yet?
Yeah, it's interesting that was kind of a blindside to the rest of the Power 5 leagues. I don't think that's a stretch to say that. You've seen since then, Greg Sankey has said, you know, they want to wait till the end of July to figure out what the SEC is going to do. I think Bob Bowlsby has tried to be pretty, like, you know, cautious and one step at a time with all this. And I think he's sort of in that same boat of hoping that things look a little bit better in 2 weeks. But that's all it is. It's just hope at this point. And part of that is, like, you know, you can sit there and sort of like, you know, have your own take on how things should be. But at the end of the day, people are canceling their games. So, you know, the SEC can say, we want to play non-conference play, but if everybody else cancels on you, then, you know, that's the decision that it's been made for you. So it's interesting to see that stuff happen. You know, and it's funny, like we're going to talk about like running a season preview on Texas, but like, I don't know, man, it feels pretty different to talk about it now if you're like, well, there's no LSU game, right? Or you're not open against USF or any of that stuff. Like it's, I joked about that with Tom Herman when I talked with him for the story of like, I told him straight up a few weeks ago, like, hey man, your season opener might be K-State. And he just laughed because he's like, yeah, we've spent months getting ready for LSU and USF and UTEP. And that might have been a total waste of time. So it's hard to talk about this stuff not knowing what's coming around the corner. But I think certainly non-conference play right now is in jeopardy. And it kind of makes sense because then it at least makes those Power 5 leagues, it's easier for them to just sort of stick to their own group and trying to move around the, you know, navigate the schedule and stuff, whether it's later in the fall or the spring or on time or whatever. It makes sense, I guess, for these decisions to be kind of kept within a conference and to sort of break off some of those commitments.
Yeah, it does. I understand why they would do it from both, you know, it gives you at least a little bit of a delay, you know, because those conference games do typically start later in the season. And then you talked about, you know, the geographic aspect in terms of the travel. And you, for the most part, although the Big 12 would have an interesting discussion with West Virginia being kind of a pain in the ass trip to make for those Big 12 teams.
Yeah.
And even, you know, the Iowa States and stuff like that, too. But you would think, you know, generally speaking, okay, the travel and things like that, we could help kind of mitigate all those things. You know, when I saw the Big Ten news and I saw the SEC kind of statement that followed, I tend to think, and I don't know if you agree with me or not, I tend to think that the SEC still kind of holds the power card in all of this. Like, if the SEC comes out and there could be some non-conference teams on their schedule that are just – in leagues or in situations that they're not playing those games. But I have a hard time imagining if the SEC comes out and say, hey, you know what, we're going to play our full schedule. If they don't kind of swing the biggest power card in that situation from the standpoint of having more conferences, at least trying to follow in their footsteps, because let's be honest, I mean, they're the big power brand in college football right now.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I think all of this sort of, it makes it really clear to everybody, and I think this is going to be the case for the rest of the year here. You know, we've all seen just how ineffective these things are dealt with at the NCAA level. It's really going to come down to the conferences making their own decisions on how they want to do things, making their own decisions on what are their testing standards going to be for COVID-19 and, you know, sort of the how many times you're testing and, you know, how long people are isolating and quarantining and stuff like that. I just think that stuff, the conferences are a little bit more agile and on the same page when it comes to making policies right now. And I think that's important to point out because obviously we're going to get to a point here when you like stuff like that, the nitty gritty of that stuff, you're like, well, wait a minute, how can Conference USA spend the same amount of money on testing and the regularity of testing that the University of Texas can? There's just no way that the schools in their league can. So it kind of makes sense to sort of stick with your peers a little bit. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I think the Big Ten, I think that's part of what was shocking about the Big Ten move, at least in the timing of it, is first of all, you know, did they need to do it on the date they did it? Maybe not necessarily. And then, yeah, I think you would sort of, most people would assume that people take their cues from the SEC. And I think Greg Sankey is a pretty effective leader. But you saw it back in March, Dustin. I mean, when it's time for decision making, it's slow, and there's just going to be some people that say, you know what, we're not going to wait to hear whether there's an NCAA tournament. We're going to make our own decision. And that's, unfortunately, it seems like we're heading in that direction, even though we've had so much more time to get prepared for this.
Yeah, I know. It's a bummer that, you know, I was thinking back to the conversation and the stuff we were writing about kind of in mid-May and early June, and it was, the conversation was how many fans were going to be in the stands. It wasn't a matter of whether there was going to be a season in the fall or not. So it's like we've had all this time, which, I mean, the cancellation of the basketball tournaments, the conference tournaments, and then March Madness feels like it was like 8 years ago. I mean, if it feels like,
sure,
it was,
but like
so
when you're sitting in, you went to Kansas City, right, tournament?
No, we were.
Oh, you didn't?
Yeah, just kind of the way things were heading, it was like, not going
to
risk it.
Yeah, not worth it, right? But even on a, you think back to that crazy day right after the Rudy Gobert positive test and all that stuff, where all these conferences are waiting until right before tip-off to figure out, oh, we can't play this tournament.
I think
that's kind of, it feels like that's kind of where we're at right now with the scheduling and a lot of these things where, you know, it sort of feels like the dominoes are starting to fall here a little bit. Now, I don't know what that means for the fall, but at least in terms of trying to make compromises and plans here, the pressure definitely feels like it's been cranked up.
Yeah, no, I believe so. I think we can't get through the month of July without these decision makers making at least some sort of plan or to kind of sticking to their guns in some sort of way, because we're the clock is winding down in that regard. Yeah. And I think the Big Ten might have looked at what happened with the basketball tournaments and saw that, you know what, if you're one of the first leagues to stick your neck out there and make a decision, you might be able to get everybody else to follow in your footsteps. But yeah, it's just truly an unprecedented time. And they've had this much time to prepare, but at the same time, it's like, how do you prepare for any of this when it's just constantly changing all the time? So, then there's you mentioned the NCAA aspect, and I wonder if this is probably maybe another discussion for another podcast, but I wonder if you've got a lot of the powerful conferences and decision makers and ADs and presidents at some of these top schools are kind of asking themselves, why do we need the NCAA? Like, where is the NCAA in all this? And then the NCAA is just kind of like, hey, you guys go ahead and do what you think you need to do.
I mean, they put out a statement last week that literally just basically said, like, you guys got this.
It's cool. Go for it. We believe in you. Yeah, you go ahead and navigate this, and we'll just kind of hang out in the corner and collect the money from it. I got to wonder if an unintended consequence in all of this is this – the beginning of the end of the NCAA as we know it, you know. And
and you think back to March when when Mark Emmert and the NCAA finally made the decision they had to make on the NCAA tournament, the thing that none of us really saw coming is they said, we're canceling all spring sports, no baseball, no anything else, right? And I remember how pissed off Greg Sankey and a lot of people were of saying, like, well, wait a minute, why did that all get wrapped up in this basketball decision, right? And so I think that's since then you see these conferences understanding, well, we're not going to sit back here and wait to see, you know, what surprise the NCAA lobs our way. I think we got to be the ones that make these choices.
Yeah. And I think they understand that, hey, the NCAA can't really make money without us. You know, it's, you know, the March Madness stuff specifically, like that's a huge deal to the NCAA, to where if they've got some programs or leagues are like, yeah, you know what, we could kind of branch off, I think, and do our own thing, and suddenly the NCAA would be in a lot of trouble. So yeah, I mean those decision makers have so much on their plate currently that's kind of just probably in the very distant back part of their minds, but I'm sure it's come up at some point, like, where are they at all in this? And, you know, if we're just doing this all on our own, what would change in the future if just we continue to do this all on our own and cut them out of the process?
Right. Well, and I think we've seen in a lot of like steps in this process, I think you've seen people say, hey, why isn't there just a football czar that just sort of helps oversee this stuff? Because that's clearly not the role of Mark Emmert or the NCAA. You know, that's just not something that they're very effective in doing, and part of that is because of sort of the legislative differences and the haves and have-nots of the Power Five and Group of Five and all that. But I mean, that's a thing that has been, you know, in this whole process, like the thing I've clung to in terms of optimism is, look, there's a lot of powerful people that are very desperate, who are, you know, stand to lose a ton of money and who are going to figure out a way to do this, you know, by any means necessary. And I don't say that to say, you know, that I don't care about the student athlete labor or anything like that. I'm not trying to be cold about that. I'm just saying that there's the motivation is to figure out a way to get this done, because we know it's going to be devastating for athletic departments. But, you know, the thing that worries you a little bit as you watch this play out against, you know, the NBA and Major League Baseball and stuff is, you know, there's a pretty clear leadership structure in the NBA between the commissioner and the Players Association on how things get done. And that's just, you know, all this sort of shines a light that in college football, it's just way more messed up from a leadership standpoint.
No, you're exactly right. It's a great point. I mean, not only the professional element, but like there's not really any consistency across the board. And college
like the Rob Manfred, Tony Clark stuff was bad, but at least you knew who the people were that were making the call, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You knew ultimately what the two sides were arguing about and who made the decisions. In college football, right. It's just you get all these independent programs and to a lesser extent these conferences are the ones just in charge of making these decisions. And then you're asking them to kind of have a consistent playing field across the board. And we saw the Big Ten stuff. It's like, well, you might have some people that don't align in their ideology and some people that are kind of caught off guard with that. So I'm optimistic like you, because let's face it, like you said, the reality of the situation is there's going to be a lot of athletic departments that are absolutely devastated if there's not a college football season. I don't think the average fan understands there's not really many of those athletic departments that to begin with that really make revenue. You know, if you're breaking even for the most part, you're doing a pretty good job. And if you don't have football, suddenly a lot of those athletic departments are in big, big trouble. So, I'm optimistic because there's just so much.
Well, I mean, you look at the – yeah. For sure. I mean, you look at the statement from Jamie Pollard from Iowa State this week. He said their athletic department stands to lose $40 million in the next 6 months if they can't play sports. Yeah. You can't just, like – trim a little off here and there off your budget to get 40 million, man. You know, that's you're talking about cutting sports, cutting staff, cutting coaches.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's bare minimum if you're doing that. So it really exposes how sort of poorly structured just this whole business is.
Yeah, and it's not something like a pay cut can save, you know.
No.
As nice as it is to see, you know, some of these really rich head coaches and people kind of accepting some pay cuts, that doesn't solve the issue if there's no football. And I think that's one of the reasons why you're seeing some decision makers in the Big 12 and probably the SEC and some of these other leagues as well trying to delay this, because they know if they come to a decision, they're like, okay, like we got to cut these games or we got to do this or you know, move this season to the spring. They understand that they're going to have to do some serious changes in their athletic department in terms of getting, you know, firing people, furloughing people, laying off people, whatever. It just would be a tough pill to swallow. But let's act like for a second, or at least for a few minutes here on this podcast, that there's going to be a fall football season, whether it's just conference games, the total schedule, whatever it is. Let's act like there's going to be a football season, and let's talk about your state of the program story that you did on the Texas Longhorns. You mentioned that you talked to Tom Herman for this story. First off, what was just your general takeaway about how he feels about the upcoming season that would happen on the field? I kind of felt like, you know, since he's arrived at Texas and he's talked about his program more and more and we hear things behind the scenes, it's always felt like, you know, 2020, that fourth year for him has been the one he's felt like would be a real breakthrough. And I know last season obviously didn't go like they thought it would. But I always remember back to him saying how they were kind of ahead of schedule with that Sugar Bowl season, kind of referencing to, hey, we think that there's much bigger things beyond once we get some of these guys older in our programs, once we recruit more, so on and so forth. So what was just your general takeaway after talking to him about how he feels about this upcoming season?
Yeah, it's interesting. He has said, he has said to me now on the record that they've circled 2020 a long time ago as the year that they thought would be, the big year. And that's not just because Sam's a senior. It's because, that recruiting class, that first, you know, number three ranked recruiting class they brought in, those guys are juniors now, third year guys. And I think we kind of knew last year when you saw a lot of those guys being plugged into starting roles as sophomores, or redshirt freshmen, I think you kind of figured, okay, there's probably still going to be a little bit of growing pains with that group, and that group would kind of, you know, determine how far you go. And obviously progress with these things are not just super easy and linear. You have injuries and setbacks, all that kind of stuff. But I think they felt like the core of the roster now is what you want it to look like. I think when you try and go through and come up with a depth chart for Texas, the thing that stands out this offseason is just there's real competition at a lot of spots. You say, what do they do at receiver or offensive line? They've got a lot of different guys that can take over some of those spots and push each other and make each other better. And I think, you know, cornerback is another one where you have some guys that have played now, don't know who the two starters are, but you've got a lot of competition there. And so I think, you know, they feel like that part of it is on schedule. Now, the question is how far off schedule did they get in 2019, right? Because the pandemic wasn't part of the plan, and having to let go of most of your coaching staff and start over on that front and hire two new coordinators wasn't part of the plan for 2020 being the big year. So I think the thing that you still wonder is just, from an X's and O's standpoint, you know, Mike Yersich and Chris Ash and the new coaches have had more time than ever to teach what they want to teach. It's just, once you take it to grass, how long is it going to take for this team to kind of click, for this team to sort of get it? You know, obviously, offensively, you're not making a dramatic change in what you do. Defensively, I think it's a pretty fundamental change in a lot of ways, not just in going to a four-man front, but even just in teaching them how to tackle the way Chris Ash wants to tackle. So there's like a lot you have to accomplish in August when you actually have a chance to practice because you lost all of your spring practices. That part of it, I think, is interesting in terms of figuring out, all right, can this team still kind of reach its ceiling? But, Tom Herman is still – I think he's argued throughout the offseason that they're still on the right trajectory here despite the struggles of last season. And you know, I think I get it. I believe it. I think they're going to be better. It's just a matter of, you know, as we talk about this today, we just have no idea what that season even looks like.
Yeah, no, it's he made the staff changes he needed to make, but obviously nobody could foresee a pandemic coming. And just that's, yeah, you know, if there is a season or whatever the season is, like how much the inability to have a spring football or have all these, you know, preseason workouts, if they're not going to, you know, have them delayed or whatnot or whatever, how much that impacts just this coaching staff's transition will remain to be seen. But that's absolutely a question. It's something that they're going to have to deal with. You brought up that recruiting class from 2018, those guys that they're going to be juniors now.
Yeah.
I've long felt that group will really define what Tom Herman's Texas tenure is going to be, because let's be honest, if that group goes 4 years into the program and they move on and there's not a high level of success at Texas, chances are Tom Herman's seat's probably going to be at least a little bit warm heading into fifth and those six seasons and beyond. And I really think part of the reason why he made a lot of these coaching changes, and it's a word that he's used a lot, is development. And I think he looked at that class specifically, a lot of these guys that are going to be juniors, a lot of these guys are really big time recruits, and the competition aspect is good, and it's true, especially at, you know, wide receiver, running back to a lesser extent, definitely at defensive back. You got a lot of really talented guys there. But the development aspect, I think, is a big reason why he made a lot of those changes, because they just weren't quite seeing enough of that development, mainly in those 2018 guys who I think are going to define what his tenure is like.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. You know, one thing that it's worth pointing out on those two classes, those two really highly ranked classes, the retention rate on that talent has been really good. They haven't really lost very many guys. I mean, obviously Brew McCoy and like Cam Rising, there's like a couple notable ones, but you know, there's you look at their roster today, and there are 45 players on that team from the 2018 and 2019 classes that are still in the program. 18 of them have already started games over the last two seasons. And you've only lost eight guys from those two classes combined. So I think that part of it, like you've got what you need. Keeping that attrition to such a low percentage is really important in kind of setting that foundation for you. And then, I should say Anthony Cook, that's another key loss from those classes. But I mean, you've got the talent there now. And then that, yeah, what do you do to develop them? And I think some of the issues that led to, you know, parting ways with like Todd Orlando, for example, Tom Herman has told me that, you know, the frustrating thing for him last year is when they had injuries, they, you know, were unable to really plug freshmen into roles and see them play really well. And he was wondering, you know, why is that? Is that because the defense is too complicated? You know, can we find a way to just do a couple blitzes and a couple coverages and like kind of simplify and just let these guys play fast and physical? And I think he really feels like Chris Ash is going to let them do that. It's a lot simpler now defensively, and I think that helps you in getting those guys to start playing to the kind of the right potential. But you know, it's funny, the other part of this that we kind of have stopped talking about is the hot seat part, because as this, you know, as this pandemic goes on and you have you know, Crystal County and everybody else trying to figure out how the budget's going to work for this year. Like, bottom line, Tom Herman would be owed $15 million and his staff would be owed about $10 million if they pulled the plug at the end of this year. So
yeah, whether there's a season or not, it's just it's just a look at the Texas basketball program.
For sure. For sure. It's just a non-starter in these conditions right now. So I think that helps buy him a little bit more time and patience. But at the same time, you know, when you put expectations on a year like this, and obviously they were high last year too, you got to deliver.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as you know better than I, when you see programs hiring coordinators this, you know, after three full seasons, it's you don't get to do that very often. You usually get one swing at that type of thing.
Yeah, Del Conte said you get one chance to do that. I mean, straight up, he said it. So, yeah. You know.
And that's how it works. That's how it works. And that's, I mean, frankly, that's how it should work. You know, this is an opportunity for Texas. It's something we haven't really been able to say about Texas, I think, in a while, is they could, I mean, arguably speaking, they could have the best offensive lineman and defensive lineman in the Big 12, you know, in Sam Cosmi and then Joseph Osai. Specifically Osai, I was looking back the other day at just Texas's track record in the NFL draft with pass rushing type guys. So basically 4-3 defensive ends or those 3-4 outside linebackers that are drafted as pass rushers, like a Brian Arakpo. Who was a first-round pick. And then you have to go all the way back to, I think, 1982 before Texas had another first-round pick in that sort of role, a pass rusher-type role. What do you think is on the horizon for Joseph Osai? Just how good do you think that guy could be? And is he good enough to be a guy that could break that trend and be one of those first-round picks at that position for Texas?
It's funny, you think back a few years, like we sort of felt like Jackson Jeffcoat and Cedric Reed would kind of be in this spot too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you deal with injuries and setbacks and stuff like that, and it doesn't, you know, that senior year doesn't really go the way you want. Joseph Osai's not a senior, man. He's still really young and just a freaky talent who, you know, you look at the numbers at the end of the year, and obviously the bowl game was huge, but, you know, a team-high 90 tackles, 13.5 tackles for loss, 5 sacks and 2 picks. I mean, he had a phenomenal year. And I think I just think it the future is really, really bright for him and move into this jack role in their defense. You know, we saw it in the bowl game when they played a 4-man front, kind of just how effective he could be against a really good Utah team. And I think, you know, if you can keep that dude healthy and keep him developing, like, yeah, I think you've probably got the best pass rusher or one of the best pass rushers in the Big 12 there. So you know, you got that part of it right. And then I mean, like, I don't know. I feel like in past years or in the strong era and stuff, we would be talking about this stuff and we'd be saying, oh, wow, they really need Vernon Broughton and Alfred Collins and Prince Dorba to like play right away and be really good. And that's finally Texas is at a point where that's not the case, you know, where like Taquan Graham's probably like a little bit underrated and like Keandre Coburn, you know, started all last year and knows what he's doing. Tavondre Sweat's really good. I think Mora Ojemo is going to be really good. So like they finally kind of have the depth now, where a guy like Osai can play and be really fresh and be able to sub and stuff and not just get banged up and worn down.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, you mentioned the word retention earlier. Definitely didn't happen under Charlie Strong. There wasn't much retention with those recruiting classes, which I think
or Texas, the D-line classes, man. You know, I mean, you remember the one with you know, Jordan Elliott and all those guys that busted pretty hard, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just kind of the excitement level of getting some of those guys late in the process, and then you look and see what happened. And it's something that I think Texas fans may not give enough attention to, and just what Tom Herman inherited in that regard was there was just so much roster turnover and a lack of retention from some of those classes that you really were kind of starting over with the program. I think it's probably easy to say that linebacker's got to be the biggest concern for this group. Yeah. If you're looking at position groups, what was kind of your feel from Herman about just, you know, how big of a concern they think that is? Because they've got to keep Juwan Mitchell in the mix, who kind of is a guy that sometimes flirts with leaving the program.
Yeah.
Obviously, DeMarvion Overshown, you know, based on his tweet to the recent news that Texas released on Monday about some changes around campus in the athletic department, seems like he's satisfied with that. Is I would think, inferring from that tweet, that which is kind of what we have to do now as college football analysts and writers, that he's going to be back in the mix. But the depth is just there's not a whole lot there. So how big of a concern do you think that is for them?
Yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, Juwan Mitchell has already gone into the transfer portal once this offseason, went through and has tweeted that he's not, you know, comfortable wearing the jersey and all that kind of stuff. So you sort of like got to keep him on track. He's kind of like the one guy, you know what he can do. And even then last season, it was still just kind of flashes from him that he could play at a high level. DeMarvion Overshown, like, I don't think they've at the point we're talking today, like, I don't even know that he's on campus yet. Right. So like, you know, how do you sort of like,
either, yeah.
Right. So how do you plug him in for the Will linebacker job if the dude's not even on campus? Right. So, you know, as long as he sits out activities, I think he's fallen behind. And that's a player that, again, that's, you're asking a lot of him. He's still just kind of just learning linebacker and converting from safety. He's had injury history. So it's like, it's hard to depend on the guys at the top of the line there. And then, you know, that puts some guys in positions where, you know, they may have to really contribute. I mean, it's, you know, Delia Dayaway, he has starting experience. You know, David Benda hasn't played a ton. Marcus Tillman looked really good last year, but is coming off injuries. You know, Court. I mean, you got to count Court, the king of the walk-ons.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
The dude who's, you know, got the Home Depot lifting set up at his place. You know, like, you know, that's where they're at. I mean, unless you're going to get a guy like B.J. Foster or like Tyler Owens to go play linebacker, which you kind of maybe you have to just to get them on the field. Yeah, it's a big old question mark, and Coleman Hutzler's got he's got a lot that he's got to figure out with this group in a short period of time.
So overall, just let's say that there's a, you know, on paper we're thinking about a 12-game schedule. How do you think, you know, what do you think the ceiling of this Texas team is, and what do you think is probably the most realistic outcome for them under normal circumstances? Okay, we should clarify that.
Well, how about we say they're just playing the conference schedule?
Yeah, okay, that's fair. Yeah, and we know that they haven't had that practice time and that sort of thing. What do you think is a realistic outcome for them, and what do you think is their ultimate ceiling as a team this season?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, like, even with the Big Ten and Pac-12 saying they're not playing enough non-conference games, we haven't actually seen what their schedule's going to be. And I think that I wonder that a little bit with Texas, too, of, like, if the Big 12 – dumps their non-conference games, I think you still have to kind of rework the schedule because as it stands today, the first two games for Texas are a trip to Manhattan, which is never very fun for them, and then Red River, which we've already seen the State Fair of Texas is canceled. So I imagine that, I mean, is that game movable to a different date? I don't know. But you wonder sort of how much does that schedule get reworked and retweaked. But I think overall, if you're just talking about playing conference play, look, we got to remember they went 5-4 in league play last year, and so did a bunch of good teams: Oklahoma State, Iowa State, Kansas State. The Big 12 beats people up. I mean, that's just kind of how it's going to be. You're going to play a lot of close games, and if you're playing a conference-only schedule, I actually would argue that you know, it's more difficult than what they had before. Where yeah, the LSU trip is tough, but at least you have two wins in South Florida and UTEP that you can kind of build on. In Big 12 play, it's going to be it really requires your best football. Right away for a coaching staff that is still, you know, still teaching what they're trying to do. So, like, I think the ceiling is that they can play, you know, in a hypothetical Big 12 title game with Oklahoma or Oklahoma State. But, you know, it also depends on the time of year, man. Like, if we're playing a spring season, I don't think Chuba Hubbard and Tylan Wallace are playing football in the spring, right? So, like, then Oklahoma State's not a contender. So, it's like, there's really no telling today, like, what that ends up looking like. But, I mean, as of today, I think the ceiling is Texas can be one of the best teams in the Big 12. But, you know, you've got to find a way to survive some really tough games. And last year, they weren't able to do that.
Yeah, I don't want to – I mean, it'd be nice to have football back, but I don't want to live on our message board if they start 0-2 with a loss at K-State and then they lose to Red River. But it's a great point. Like, if that's what the schedule would be, yeah, that's a tough way for a basically almost completely –
And playing the Cotton Bowl in, like, an empty –
Oh, that'd be so weird.
I mean, think about Red River with no state fair and no fans.
It's depressing. It's depressing. It's to me, it's the best atmosphere in college football. because you don't really get many of those environments where it's basically split and then you're just kind of playing football with a fair around there. It's totally unique.
Just playing a scrimmage basically. It's so weird, you know?
And that's something like, I don't know if they would like tell programs, okay, you can have like a couple of maybe an exhibition game, like against a local program, like a, you know, I don't know what they would do. It's all up in the air. But yeah, I tend to agree with you that this should be a team that gets to the Big 12 championship game, but it's certainly not a guarantee based on recent history.
Well, and I feel like we got to mention, if we're going to like sort of try to talk through schedule stuff at all, like, it's just going to take a lot of luck this year with the way things are. I mean, you could have, you know, you could have a deal where your position room gets a couple positive tests.
Oh, yeah.
And you're, you know, those guys are out for 2 weeks. I mean, who knows, you know? Yeah. So it's going to take, even in good planning and good talent and all that stuff, like, it's still just going to take a lot of luck to get through a season this fall. And I think that's why it all just feels really, you know, uncertain and untenable in some ways.
It's going to be like Pac-12 after dark all the time. It's just going to be some like really weird stuff happening in like every game and every week. And yeah, I mean, you're seeing it with like the Houston Rockets right now, like James Harden was late to camp. Wonder why, even though nobody's reported it. And then Russell Westbrook announced he was, you know, COVID-19 positive. And it's like, you know, those are like that's a championship contending team that obviously is way different. It could slide down the standings if those two guys are out for the beginning of the NBA season.
I guess that's maybe where, like, I don't know, maybe in some ways Texas is well set up for this, because not just because they have depth, but like, at least they're at a point now where, like, offensively they can score a ton of points, you know? And you kind of thought that would be the case last year where, like, okay, yeah, the defense is going to be younger and have some issues, and, like, maybe the offense can cover up for that. And that just did, you know, there was just really some stretches last year where that just really wasn't the case. But when you think about what they have at running back and wide receiver now, they really like Jared Wiley at tight end. You've got, you know, a first rounder on the offensive line, and I think some really good competitions there. And you've got probably the best quarterback in the Big 12 when he's playing his best. So, like, at least, if the defense isn't where it needs to be under Chris Ash, like, at least you should be able to score a ton of points. And maybe Texas is better set up to survive, you know, shootouts this year.
Yeah, I would think so. And that's what Tom Herman, I think, is betting on. I think when he looks back, and this is something he's kind of talked about publicly, you know, he wasn't his best version of himself as an offensive play calling guy and also as a head coach. And because he really, and it's just, I think, kind of rare for a head coach, is that he really doesn't want that total control of the offense. He wants somebody that kind of shares his ideology that he can hand that to. I think he's betting on that Mike Yurcich is kind of his major Applewhite again. And, you know, looking back at what they did at Houston, that's when things were really, really clicking. You mentioned Sam. It's such an interesting career up to this point. Like,
yeah.
I always go back and read the stat about, oh, he's going to enter the year as the active leader in yardage among Power 5 guys. Like, that's kind of makes you stop your tracks a little bit and be like, man, this guy's played a lot of football. He's had some really, really bright moments. But just that consistency element, like it seems he's a consistent season away from being a, I don't know, maybe even an All-American guy. Would you agree?
Yeah. Our, you know, Dane Brugler, who does our draft coverage at The Athletic, he went through and evaluated, you know, all the quarterbacks in this 2021 draft. And he surprised even himself in going through the tape and determining that he felt like Sam Ellinger was the fifth best quarterback in this upcoming class, you know. And that's, you know, I think there's that kind of potential. And he kind of compared it to, you know, Jalen Hurts a little bit, which I think is probably not maybe the right comparison in terms of their playing style, but, you know, can he be that second or third round kind of guy who people are like, you know what, this dude's a leader. He's really tough. He's versatile. He makes us better. Like I could see Sam Ellinger, you know, if he can stay healthy, playing his way into that kind of talk, because I think I don't think he probably gets enough credit for just how much he's, you know, improved as a passer. And I've talked about that with Tim Beck in the past, that they've really cleaned up the way he throws and just how efficient he is. And I think, you know, it hasn't been super consistent in terms of playing at a high level for long stretches. for a bunch of reasons. But I think when we've seen Sam Ehlinger playing well, and you know, you go back to you think about the LSU game last year. It's not like Sam Ehlinger lost that game by any means. He played his ass off against Joe Burrow and a defense that was full of first rounders and high level guys. So I think we've seen in big games against LSU and Oklahoma and Georgia and all that, this dude can play really well at a high level. Maybe it looks a little bit different than other people just in terms of, you know, he's a runner, but he's not going to get you big yardage. But he's just a really, really effective dude who I think, you know, part of – honestly, I think part of the Yursich hire is that Mike Yursich knows how to play with a guy like that and build an offense around him. You've seen the differences in how they played with Mason Rudolph versus Taylor Cornelius versus what he did with Justin Fields last year. Like, I think that hire is really kind of a home run in terms of this dude's going to know how to build a passing game and a run game around the quarterback.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and I think it was interesting. I went back and looked at Yursich specifically with Rudolph. Just the progression that those offenses made, and even Ohio State did this too in a couple of key areas that Texas, I mean, if you could nitpick at their offensive statistics, were kind of, you know, average or worse at. And, you know, specifically, I saw you did a story recently about it was like the yardage per play for quarterbacks. And Ehlinger, obviously, you know, he's got those kind of those power runs types of things that'll kind of ding that a little bit. But if you look,
the three runs for first downs don't really get
you. They don't, those don't help you. Yeah. Those don't help you in the overall play efficiency, but this is still a guy that, you know, wasn't top 20 nationally in, you know, adjusted yards per passing attempt and statistics like that. It seems like there's an element that can be unlocked. Yeah. Which is something that Yursich has did a lot with Mason Rudolph. You saw every year he was a starter. Those numbers kind of went up. He was more efficient. There was more balls down the field, that sort of thing. And that's what Ohio State did. Even, you know, Dwayne Haskins threw 50 touchdowns, and yet Ohio State, at least in some of those statistics, was a better offense the next year, kind of throwing the ball down the field and stuff like that. It seems like that marriage could really, really work.
I think so. And I just think, like, we probably aren't talking enough about the fact that, like, you know, I think Keyonte Ingram has a chance to be one of the best junior running backs in the Big 12 and maybe in the country. But he's also going to have to share it a lot with Roshan Johnson and with Bijan Robinson. And I think, like, I think Robinson can be, you know, one of those guys that's in the mix for Big 12 newcomer of the year if he gets enough carries. Like, I think that balance, and you saw it last year, Ohio State knew in big games to lean on J.K. Dobbins. That, like, I think the if you can keep those guys healthy, and that was obviously a problem last year. But I think that balance that you have of that run game, and just at the end of the year, Ingram actually had a really nice year. Ended up with close to 1,100 total yards and 10 touchdowns. I think that part of it gives you balance, and that helps you make up for the fact that, you know, it would have been nice to have spring practices just to see, you know, what does the next step look like for Jake Smith or for Marcus Washington, you know, Jordan Whittington getting healthy, things like that. Obviously you add Tariq Black, which I think makes them a lot better. And I've heard, I mean, when I asked Tom Herman, what's the ceiling for Brennan Eagles? He said first round. He said he's 6'4", 229, and he's running a sub 4.4. So the potential's there with that receiving group. I think Sam's got enough to work with there. It's just one of those deals where, again, it would be good to have spring ball and kind of work through the kinks and stuff like that. And instead, you're kind of having to do that stuff, you know, really in the next few weeks here, if everything can, you know, fingers crossed, kind of stay on schedule to at least get some practices in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Well, we'll end with some rapid fire ones here because I've kept you long enough already. I don't know if you're like me, but the quarantine has increased my beer consumption.
Oh yeah.
I've just not like an extreme 2008
kind of way. But this is like we're supporting local, man. Like
absolutely.
You know, that's how you got to think about it. You got to support your local breweries, and it's just a benevolent and generous thing that we're doing to buy up all this beer, you know.
Yes. And, you know, and tweeting about it and trying a new one every night or something along those lines. It's been a very fun endeavor. It's like I don't recall ever having like more than like six beers in a day the last like 4 months, but There's been a lot of days where there's been at least like one or two just to kind of, all right, it's 7 o'clock. I've been in the house all day again for like the third straight month. Why don't I mix it up a little bit? So
yeah.
You got any new ones you've tried recently or any go-tos that you really dig right now?
Well, I'll tell you. Well, okay. So I should preface this by saying, you know, I don't live in Austin anymore, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about that. This is newborn.
So I'm living in Lincoln, Nebraska, and we moved back home. My wife and I moved back home last summer because she got a job at the university, and we wanted to be closer to family and all that to, you know, start our family. And so we did that last summer.
You're just angling to become the Nebraska AD someday. Let's just be honest about that.
There's been enough turbulence there that it'll open up one of these days. But, you know, but the thing is, so despite moving, I'm still – like torturing myself by following Austin Beer Works and Zilker and Real Ale and Pint House and like all these breweries on Instagram and stuff. So I just absolutely torture myself every day with like seeing all the new stuff they're coming out with. And it's incredible. Like Zilker's putting out new stuff all the time. Beer Works is like cranked up its production of like new different stuff with this beer to go stuff. That's just like really, it's just really upsetting to see. Like I had some friends for my birthday. They shipped me a care package that had 2 6-packs of Flavor Country from Austin Beer Works, and so that's the Austin beer that I'm guzzling right now and missing dearly. But honestly, anything at Pint House or Beer Works or Zilker, I would pay a pretty penny to get shipped here.
Well, yeah. Well, I'll have to send you a little care package. How do you execute such a care pack? Like, how does that even work?
Yeah, just a small, you know, if you can get a box and get some bubble wrap going. Like, I've had a few when Sputnik came out from Beer Works in the winter. I had some friends send me some, and you put it in a box with some bubble wrap, and you can get away with it. I haven't had any that busted or anything.
Interesting.
Not bottles, obviously, but cans work.
Yeah, but the plus to the move is you're in like the heart of Boulevard Country, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, we're three. That's one of those things that it kills you that we can't, you know, we haven't really been doing any traveling this summer or anything because the Boulevard Beer Hall is, you know, 3 hours away. And it's that is a marvelous place. I assume you've been there on your Kansas City trips, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like it's one of those breweries to where if I'm ever up there, because I go at least once a year for the Big 12 basketball media days every time. And it's like no questions asked if I see something on the menu from them. Like that brewery is like, I'm going to try it. And I try to veer towards ones I haven't had before. Obviously their wheat it has been a staple forever. Many of those covering the College World Series, but yeah, that's the one to where I go the peanut, I get some wings. I try something peanut. Boulevard lately.
Absolutely, man.
Related. And then I just go from there. Like the peanut, anything similar to that in Lincoln or anything?
No, you know what's so funny? We just like some news just came out yesterday that they're like opening a Wingstop near my neighborhood, which is like the first Wingstop in Lincoln. And it's like I would go to Wingstop every once in a while in Austin. Nothing against it or anything. It's solid. And so here it'll probably like be a big deal that we've got one. But there's a couple places that do wings pretty well, but I'm missing Pluckers, man. I really miss Pluckers. It's when my wife and I came down to Austin for a weekend. In March, literally like right before things got really at it, like probably a week before we were all really taking this really seriously. We got really lucky and squeezing a trip in, and we landed at the airport and she wanted to go to Pluckers right away.
You found the one. That's how you know. Like it's as simple as that. If that's the first move off the airplane, you definitely found the one. And
for sure.
Yeah, we'll they do sell some bottled sauce, so we'll have to include that.
So I got a buddy to ship me I believe it was the Buffalo Medium. Couple bottles of Buffalo Medium, and oh my god, man, it is so much better than I remember in some ways. You know what I mean? Like it's you can't I hope your listeners are not taking Pluckers for granted and all the sauce options there. And, you know, we were joking about this the other day about, I'm curious to hear what it is for you. Like we were joking about, well, if we were still in Austin, what would be the things we would be doing takeout of all the time? What's it been for you?
It's been, we just actually did Pluckers on Monday. Nice. Cause they're doing those deals to where it's basically like you get a free app if you spend $30. So I'm like, okay, well I'll get like two
easy
or three meals worth of wings. And then just whatever the app is, just throw it on there. So a lot of that, you know, definitely the taco type places as well, whether it's Taco Flats, Torchy's, those kind of places. Taco One, like their brick and mortar is Taco near where we live. Yep. Hop Dottie is pretty close to where we live, and they're doing some like really unbelievable deals with some of their takeout stuff. Doing some cover three on occasion. But yeah, mostly a lot of those kind of, you know, neighborhoody type places, near us. But yeah, Maudie's as well. You know, did Natsal Rancho once, which, they've been booming. They've been as busy as they've ever been. Like it's kind of crazy how many people they still try to go there, even though it's like the certain capacity. And whatnot. So yeah, definitely sticking to those. It's been a pretty solid rotation for probably three or four months now.
There's a bunch of places in Austin that like if I opened one up in Lincoln, Nebraska, I'd become a millionaire. Like if I could run a Torchy's here, I'd be like people would go crazy and I'd be crazy rich. We felt that way about like, I feel like Kirby Lane's one of those places that you could open up anywhere to.
That yeah. People
would do really well.
Menu, yeah.
But even here, honestly, man, like I think you could open a Rudy's and become a millionaire.
Oh, too, sure.
There's just not that base level of barbecue here. There should be, but there's just not that great of barbecue here.
Well, we've plotted your path. So you become a millionaire by opening one of these franchises, and then you become the Nebraska AD. Speaking of which, you obviously, you know, grew up there, followed the program very, very closely. I grew up a gigantic Florida State fan. They're kind of in similar positions program-wise. Who gets back first? I'm not talking about Joe Tessitore, Texas is back.
Yeah.
Or Charlie Strong. Who gets actually back to where the, you know, the 90s levels of these respective programs? Is it going to be Nebraska or Florida State?
I think I would be pretty fired up if I was a Florida State fan right now. I think Norvell's legit.
I do too.
I think he put together a good staff. Like, I mean, like as we sit here today, like there's a, like, you know, the ACC, like Clemson's waiting for somebody to catch up to him, right?
Yes.
Whether it's Florida State or UNC or whatever, like there's definitely room right now for someone to rise up and be that number two team in the ACC, you know, kind of consistently that pushes Clemson finally. And yeah, I would feel pretty good if I were a Florida State fan right now. They're going to get really, really talented players. And that's just the hard thing in Nebraska after all these years and leaving the Big 12 and everything is it's just the talent level is just not where it needs to be. And you thought changing the scheme with Frost and all that, you know, just his deep knowledge of Nebraska football would make that easier. But nah, man, it's pretty tough to get really, really good players at Nebraska and even just win that division. And I think it's still going to take more time. I think they would have been better this year. And we'll see kind of how this weird offseason affects that. But Nebraska's still, it's still been kind of a slow thing for them. I would think Florida State's about to take off.
Yeah, the Big Ten is so much superior right now compared to the ACC when you're looking at those teams that are competing for league titles. It's definitely Clemson. In the rest of the pack, it's even worse than it was in the 90s when Florida State was winning that league every year. You still had some quality teams, you know, from the Mack Brown, North Carolina.
There was like a totally unmemorable season from Virginia last year, and they like, you know, made the ACC title game. Didn't they even go to a New Year's Six Bowl? Like, I mean, it wasn't even that.
They were like a fringe top 25 team, if that. Like, it was like one of their best seasons, and they represent the
ACC.
It's just, you know, that's just, oof, that league is, it's kind of like the Big 12, too. There's Oklahoma, and there's kind of been the rest relative to the last years and whatnot. So it's definitely there's the taking for that second team. Well, we'll end with one last one. I saw that you had a beard going at one point.
Oh boy.
A quarantine beard as a beard man fan or whatever.
Yeah. I should have texted you and I should have asked you for beard maintenance tips.
What was that like? What made you ultimately decide to get rid of it?
I grew the beard for probably 3 months.
Wow,
I was really proud of how it went. It just sort of tried to clean underneath it. But you know, there wasn't a whole lot, like, you know, it, with barbershops kind of being shut down and stuff, there wasn't a whole lot you could do. So it was definitely a quarantine beard, but I'm proud of how it went. And my wife really, really liked it. And then one day she said, "Nope, I'm over it." And then that, and then it started getting really hot here. And, that was kind of the time to call it. But I do, I did enjoy it, and I definitely think that can come back in the winter here. But yeah, I mean, now that I think about it, I should have asked you, man. You know how to sort of live that annual beard life.
It's an art form.
Once I got into it, I was like, I don't really know how to like trim this and like sort of reduce it a little bit or anything like that. I should have asked you.
Yeah, because people don't realize you make one bad move while you're doing it's that. Over. It's over. It's gone. And I've had some close calls at times where I'm like, oh shit.
What do you use? What kind of like electric razor or whatever do you use, and what guard do you use and all that to kind of keep your beard?
I have an electric razor, which is basically I have a traditional electric razor, which, you know, has the circle things that are kind of smooth for the neck and the face if you wouldn't have a beard, and then also kind of a little trimming option as well. But I use that, and also like a specific kind of like, it's almost like a beard sideburn trimmer type thing, but it's not one of those ones with the guard. It's just, I just kind of go lightly over in the mirror and I just kind of do it that way, because I used to use one of the guard ones when I was first growing a beard. And there were a couple of times where put the guard in there and vroom, it's like the beard was like a hole in that area. It's like, well, I'm not very good at that way. So I see these commercials and they're like switching it to this guard level and just going over. And I'm like, I don't think that's how it works in real
that
life.
That seems misleading. Well, even after like my father-in-law has like always has a beard, and he just says he just like uses scissors in the mirror. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that. Like I that's something you probably get really good at over time.
It definitely takes some practice, but yeah, it usually takes me like 15 or 20 minutes to where you're just kind of going over it a certain way. And I've got a mirror in the shower where I can kind of get close and like, all right, you know, this area, whatever. But I'm definitely committed to it.
It's definitely, that's what I underestimated. It's quite a lifestyle to sort of like kind of maintain and, we'll get back there someday, but I still have a lot to learn.
Oh, it's an absolute necessity in the winter up there. Absolutely going to need it. And it's going to be, you're going to thank yourself that you can.
we'll get the beard and we'll get some flannel going, and we'll really go for it here in the winter.
There you go. You know, maybe mix in some maple syrup, go chop down some trees or something.
There you go. 100%.
Well, Max, thanks so much for the time, man. This flew by and I've kept you long enough. You can follow Max on Twitter @Max_Olson. Go check out The Athletic for all his great content. Again, he's got the State of the Program series going with Texas being one of the featured teams. Also did a really good story we talked about previously about the yards per play element with quarterbacks. And just go check out The Athletic in general. It's a place I spend a lot of time at personally. There's a lot of great work going on there. Definitely been spending some time on their fantasy baseball coverage and things like that. But follow Max for all college football news. He covers it all, longtime reporter. I feel like the Big 12 is going to always remain your wheelhouse. I mean, that's kind of your sweet spot. I'm always going to think
it's a blessing and a curse.
That's a great way to say it. So for Max, I'm Dustin McComas of OrangeBloods.com. Thank you for listening to another edition of the Dustin McComas Show on the Yak.com. Until I talk to y'all next time, stay safe, wear a mask, and take care.